from morning to night. It seemed to me heroic that someone like Mike Reardon or Mrs. Burnson did this every day, and with good humor. Even now, as he stood at the back of the group waiting for the Ferris wheel to empty, I could see that he was bantering with the boys, keeping them in line without hectoring them as I would have done. The Ferris wheel filled with children just before our group made it to the head of the line, and it began to spin slowly, a blur of smiles and antic waves to the parents and friends below. It was only late afternoon, but the lights were already on around each rim. Two circles of blue lights in the lengthening, darkening day, heavy clouds settling over the field so flat around us. I looked down. Chelsea's face was tipped back, her mouth a little open, watching the other children go up and around. And I thought I saw in her eyes the kind of sadness you sometimes see as a nurse, when a child in a wheelchair watches other children run. And then there was something else. Wonder, and shock, too, and a tearing noise I thought at first was the sound of one of the rides, until I looked up and saw that one of the cars of the Ferris wheel was half-hanging in the air, and dangling from it was a child, making a high-pitched noise, something like a cry, something like heavy breathing. Ah! 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 I ran forward, dragging Chelsea with me, and saw that another child had already fallen to the packed dirt at the side of the Ferris wheel, a boy in blue shorts and one of those buzz cuts Robert kept begging for. "He's dead," Chelsea whispered as I knelt next to him, adults and children surging around to see. There was a terrible scream, and I heard the noise as the second child's body hit something, and then she fell, remarkably, only a few yards from the other. "All right," I cried, half-turning. And in that instant, I was myself again, Francis F. Benedetto, R.N., taking no shit in the emergency room. "Here's the deal. This child can go under big time, or I can help him. But to help him, I need all of you to move back." "Oh, my God!" a woman started to shriek in a familiar timbre. "Oh, my God!" Mike came up behind me, and I said, "Tell Cindy to get a hold of Mom or Grandma or whoever the hell that is and take her someplace and calm her down. Tell Cindy to lie to her. Tell her I'm a doctor. Tell her the kids are fine. Do you know CPR?" "Yeah." "No, I mean really no CPR. Not one class at the Y." "I really know CPR." "Then come right back." I looked up and raised my voice. "I need a tie or a scarf," I called. Then, looking around at the women in T-shirts and frayed shorts, the men in jeans and singlets, I added, "Or a belt. A belt would do it." CPR, done by someone who knows how to do it, is like a calisthenic, like push-ups or leg lifts, a series of quick, synchronized, monotonous movements. Mike did it just right. The boy, who was probably concussed, began to wheeze and moan. The little girl had a compound fracture of the left leg, the bone poking jagged and white from just above her knobby, scabby little knee. But the tourniquet kept down the bleeding. She was in shock, staring straight up at the sky, whispering to herself, "Mommy, Mommy." "You're okay, sweetie," I whispered back. "You broke your leg."
"I tried to hold on," she said.
"I know." Two ambulance attendants wheeled a gurney over in a cloud of dust. "I'd figure on a couple of busted ribs," I said. "Luckily, the car they were in wasn't that far up. If they'd been at the top..." I shrugged. "Nice work," one of them said. There was blood on my dress and my hands. In the hospital, I'd learned that there are really two kinds of people in the world. People who go hard and efficient in times of terrible trouble, and the ones like, it turned out, Grandma, who scream, shriek, go limp, sink to the floor, become patients themselves. PETAs, we called them in the ER, short for pain in the ass. All of the adults with me had fallen into the take-charge group. Cindy had managed to convince the grandmother that the children would be fine, and to get her to breathe into a bag and drink an orange soda. Mr. Castro had rounded up all the boys and taken them to a tent filled with video games at the back of the fairgrounds. And Jason Illing's father had taped the whole thing. While we were dropping off the boys, explaining to parents what had happened and assuring them that all of us were fine, he went to the local news station and sold a copy to them. 6 months of being careful. Dying my roots, talking about goddamn Delaware, feeling my breathing quicken at the sight of a patrol car and feeling it slow as my son slept silently in the next room. 6 months. And that idiot, that moron, that fool, maybe ruined it with his sorry little Sony that he loved to hoist on the palm of his hand. Weighs less than a sack of sugar, he liked to say. We went to Cindy's house, where she brought out tortilla chips and salsa, perhaps in a salute to Mr. Castro, and beer in deference to the aftershock of the day's events. When we turned on the television, we were the lead story on the evening news, and there I was in the center of the film clip, a red flag to Bobby's bull. The fear I felt as I watched was worse than it had been while I worked over those children. There was the little girl, her leg bent at a horrid acute angle, and there was Beth Crenshaw, using a brown leather belt as a tourniquet. You could scarcely see my face, except for once when I turned to look back straight into the big eye of the camera. I was glowering the way I always did when I concentrated, so that a nursing professor had to take me aside once and tell me that it was important not to look as though I was going to throttle the patient while I was threading an IV line. I could imagine someone watching the television news, someone channel surfing in a motel room at Disney World or in the living room of a timeshare in Del Rey, some cop's wife, some friend of Anne's from Sodality at St. Stanley's, seeing me in that instant and saying, "My God, that woman looks a lot like Bobby Benedetto's wife, doesn't she?" I closed my eyes and let my face fall forward into my cupped hands. "Bobby," I could hear them saying, "I saw Fran on the news in Florida. Some little town up north, what was the name? At a carnival ride, taking care of some kids, a terrible accident. What's Fran doing in Florida? Lakota, that was the name of the place." "You didn't look so bad," Cindy said, patting my arm, "considering." What a ghoul Illing was. He'd panned the crowd and come to rest on Chelsea, her eyes dilated, her mouth ajar. But the terror I'd seen there for a moment was gone, and in its place was a great, overwhelming calm. Probably anyone else watching would have thought the child was in shock, but I had no doubt that she was at peace. Having seen that she was not crazy or strange, but in fact prescient, correct, that the world was indeed as frightening as she had always believed, and that it was possible for children to eat funnel cake, stand in line, wave to their friends, and then simply fall out of the sky. And the look on Robert's face, when the ambulance finally wailed off down a dirt track and into the distance, with a dust cloud behind it, was just as easy for me to read. He might as well have said it aloud. Daddy was right. Daddy was right. "Are you okay?" I'd asked him in the car on the way to Cindy's house, and he'd nodded. "Of course. Of course." He'd seen worse without ever admitting to fear, giving way to nightmares. The blank eyes again. The blank stare. My heart sank. It was like he'd traveled back in time to a place where he wouldn't let himself feel a thing. "Those kids who fell will be fine," I'd said. "I know," he'd said. When I went upstairs to use the bathroom, I found him in Chelsea's bedroom. Cindy bent over him, her arm around his shoulders. Sobs shook him and made it hard for him to talk, so that the words came out in the funny little burbles he'd babbled as a baby. There were tears and dirt mingled into a streaky mess on his face and a wad of tissues in his hand. Cindy patted his back twice and then slipped past me and out of the room. She patted me, too, on her way out, and I took her place next to Robert and held him as he sobbed some more. Finally, he managed to say, "It was just so scary, it was so scary." I held him and rocked him, and my heart was so light, laughing almost inside me, because my boy knew to be afraid, to be frightened, to cry at blood and guts and pain. It was like he was normal. It was like something was alive inside him, something that could see terrible things and know them for what they were. It had been a real accident, this one, but he hadn't even used the word. He could tell a bad thing when he saw it, and I admitted to myself that I thought he'd lost that simple gift forever until that moment. Later, when Mike took us home, the telephone was ringing. "Let it go," I said, "let it go." But Robert picked it up and then handed it to me.
"Erfink and I saw you on the news," Mrs. Levitt said. "Next time you are being a hero, don't wear a dress so everybody can see your tushy, your fanny. Ah, you know, your rear end."
"I know what a tush is, Mrs. Levitt." Mike Reardon was standing in the doorway laughing. Robert had gone upstairs. I could hear the water running. "He's fine," I said to Mike. "He's upset. It's good for him to get it out now, better than bottling it up, you know."
"I know,"
I said. "I know." He stood up and moved to the door.
"You were good today," I added.
"So were you," he said. "You were great, unbelievable. Plus, I'm happy to hear you know what a tush is." "I'm sorry I was so snotty about the CPR thing. There are just a lot of people who think they know how to do it from watching TV. I was a community ambulance volunteer for 5 years. "I didn't know that, see?" He took a step toward me with a funny little embarrassed smile and took my face in his hands. Then he kissed me, very softly, the way a boy I'd liked in 8th grade who had braces top and bottom had once kissed me, as though he was afraid something harder would hurt me or him. There were footsteps from upstairs, and he dropped his hands and moved away toward the door. "Boy," he said. The phone didn't ring for 3 days, and when it finally did, my hand lingered over it as though I was afraid the receiver would give off an electric shock. My heart pounded as I listened to the electronic timpani, clink, bang, rattle, buzz-buzz, clink. I was surprised that it had taken so long for Patty Bancroft to come looking for me. I had become her bad child, her prodigal daughter, the kind of person, like Maeve Banning at Queen of Peace, who always wound up in the principal's office, in the hot seat. "Maeve Banning," Sister Eucharista would say over the intercom after morning prayers and the Pledge of Allegiance, "please come to the office." And we'd scarcely look up. "Maeve Banning," the mothers would whisper, "would wind up, well, you know." She hadn't. Of course she hadn't. Grace told me she was a lawyer now, a partner in a big law firm, helping corporations stay out of trouble. I was Patty Bancroft's Maeve Banning. I made unauthorized phone calls. I wound up on the evening news. "Elizabeth," she said. "Beth," I said again. She could never remember that that was the name I went by, and suddenly it occurred to me that it might be because they made us all Elizabeths, that huddled in apartments and small houses and trailer parks around the United States, there was a great community of Elizabeths, like one of the medieval religious communities committed to poverty and obedience. And silence, of course. Patty Bancroft was our public face, our voice, our leader. You could tell that she enjoyed that, that it made her feel good, to have gone from being powerless in her own home to being powerful in the world. I realized that that was what had always bothered me about her, that she enjoyed her work so much. "We're working on relocating you to another part of the country," she said. "Perhaps next week, if we can set the arrangements in motion."
"What?"
"I gather that you are on television. That was a very, very foolish thing to do. And that your picture was in the newspaper. The impulse to be a good Samaritan must be deeply ingrained in someone from your professional background. But I beg of you, not just for your own sake, but for the sake of your own child and many others, don't yield to it in a public place ever again. Next time I see a kid bleeding to death, I'll remember that. There's no point in sarcasm. You've only made things difficult for you and your son. Someone will let you know next week about the relocation. My name wasn't on TV. My name wasn't with my picture in the newspaper. That's not the point. We're not leaving. I'm not uprooting my boy again. I'm afraid that's the price you will have to pay. It is not unusual for us to move one family 3 or 4 times during as many years, particularly if they call attention to themselves or are not assiduous about breaking off their ties with the past. Let me tell you something about myself, Mrs. Bancroft, I said. I like to take care of my own business. I'm someone who's made her own way all her life. And the moment I said it, I knew it wasn't true. I knew that my feeble minimum wage jobs had only been a pathetic hedge against the unpredictable life my parents made for Grace and me. A life of settling but not settling down. Of moving around but not up. And my life outside of the home we shared, Bobby and I, had been a stage set, a sham. The real Fran Flynn hadn't been the woman everyone saw in the hospital, in charge, in control. She had been a punching bag, a marionette. And now I was one of Patty Bancroft's puppets, a woman scared to run around the block, scared to let her son go alone to soccer games. A woman who'd take what she could get. Let me ask you this, Patty Bancroft said. Do you want to stay alive? It was her trump card. I could tell by the way she said it. The fact that Patty Bancroft and Bobby Benedetto so often said the same things, so often made me feel the same about myself, made me hate Patty Bancroft at that moment, no matter how much good she'd done me and Robert. But she was playing out of her league when she conjured up the worst that could happen. I'd heard it all before. I'd heard it from the master. I'd heard it when he found the card of a matrimonial lawyer in my pocket 2 years before I left. He had driven across the Verrazano Narrows Bridge from a wedding reception at 2 a.m., dead drunk, snaking the car in and out of the lanes while I held on to the edge of the seat, the sullen gray of the water framed by the slender silver cables that held the roadway miraculously aloft. "You want to get home alive, Fran?" Bobby had said over and over, like there was a right answer and I hadn't gotten it yet. The next morning he made me waffles for breakfast. Waffles and pancakes, that was all he could cook. But he made good waffles, even hungover and pissed off. Death threats and Belgian waffles with bacon. What a life. "What I'd like," I said to Patty Bancroft, "is to start paying rent on this apartment. I don't like being a charity case. I'd like to pay my own phone bills. I'm putting some money away. I don't need handouts anymore. I need the name and address of the landlord." She was quiet for a long time, and for some reason I thought she was on an airplane flying over her empire, the hidden world of women who had ceded the right to speak for themselves, even fend for themselves, to a woman who took the podium and the microphone to speak for them, fingering her pearls. Patty Bancroft talked about herself wherever she went, of how she had been married to a prosperous banker in a town in Indiana, of how he mostly beat her about the body, not on the face, so that no one ever saw when she was wearing a suit to a country club lunch or a cocktail dress to the club for dinner. I'd realized, hearing her tell it at that hospital, that it sounded less like a life than a story. If Patty Bancroft had ever been a victim, it was long, long in the past. She enjoyed being on top. The way I was enjoying at that moment, demanding custody of my own life for the first time since I started living it. I appreciate everything you've done, I added, but we like it here. My son is settled in. I have a little bit of money put away. Just tell the landlord to come see me and I'll pay for this place.
You make me very nervous, Beth, she said quietly.
I'm sorry to hear that, I said. But I'd heard that before, too. I'd heard that from Bobby. I don't know if you understand this, I finally said to Patty Bancroft, but I can't worry any more about how I make other people feel about me. I have to worry about how I feel about myself.
You have to worry about staying safe and keeping your child safe.
That too, I said. Chastity is the other vow nuns take. Maybe that was why I was scheduled to go to another town, another house, another school, another identity. Because Patty Bancroft, who said over and over again that she had finally been beaten senseless by her banker husband until her face had had to be rebuilt by one of the plastic surgeons who worked for her now pro bono, had never remarried. Maybe she knew about Mike Reardon. Maybe I'd known about Mike Reardon all along. Maybe I'd tried not to notice how awkward it was for him to look at me, even in the school library or on the sidelines of a game. Maybe I'd convinced myself that I wouldn't be seduced by how comforting it was, just to know that someone bigger than me was looking out for my son. That's what had first gotten to me about Bobby, the idea that someone would keep me safe and sound, look out for Franny better than Franny could look out for herself. The feel of his arm around me, the way he held my coat. Jesus Christ, the illusions you managed to sell yourself better than any car salesman. I'd done it again with Mike Reardon, except that instead of convincing myself that he was everything, the way I had with Bobby 20 years ago, I'd convinced myself that he was nothing at all. There was no lake in Lake Plata, just a sluggish reservoir and a community pool. But Mike took us to the ocean the Saturday after the trip to the carnival. He came with soda in the back of his Toyota and an armful of old blankets. I made fried chicken and potato salad.
Can Benny come? Robert asked.
I think it would be better this time if it was just us, I said.
Just us, like me and you?
And Mike, I said.
I can't call him that, Robert said. I have to call him Mr. Reardon.
I think when we do things like this with him, you can call him Mike.
What do you mean when we do things like this?
When we all go out together.
Are we going to go someplace together after this?
I don't know, I said.
I'm calling him Mr. Reardon, Robert said.
He compromised. He called him nothing at all. When we arrived at the beach, Robert ran toward the water, kicked his shoes aside at the tide line, and went in up to his knees while we struggled with the blanket. When Mike joined him in the surf, he moved away, as though the two were magnets, naturally, inevitably, repelling one another. When I went into the water, he positioned himself between Mike and me almost unthinkingly. To anyone watching from the long crowded stretch of white beach, flat and glittering slightly in the midday sun, our movements must have looked like choreography of a strange sort. Our conversation was like that strange dissonant modern music I picked up from time to time on classical stations, fit and starts with no melody. Mainly Mike talked to Robert, and Robert ignored him.
I hear that that team from Lake Oida is going to be good. Your mother makes good fried chicken. I brought a frisbee if you want to play.
Robert, you're being rude, I finally said.
I just don't feel like talking, he mumbled and ran back into the sea.
I stood to watch him pushing out into the deeper water. The swell of the waves, the air making a floating bolster of the seat of his striped trunks, the working of the wings of his shoulder blades as he fought the current.
He looked as though he was trying to fly, to rise up, to take off. He was a good, strong swimmer, my boy, although he'd been afraid of the water at first. But he did it to please his dad. When he was 3, went to the Y in downtown Brooklyn, dipped his little pointed face below the surface of the water as though he was going into a cave. I shouldn't have come to the beach. The beach was Bobby to me. The smell, the sharp sun, the sand. I could see his shoulders, the muscles working as he pulled his shirt over his head and swam out so that he was only a dark divot on the horizon. The lifeguards would blow their whistles and demand he come back. And slowly, arrogantly, he would. He would walk over to the lifeguard stand and speak to them, and then go back out. And this time they would leave him alone, as though he had some special dispensation from the everyday rules of safety and common sense. When Robert was smaller, he would stand at the water's edge and watch, the whole line of his back rigid. And when he was older, he would swim up and down in shallower water, parallel to the shore. And I knew he was just waiting for the day when he was brave enough to strike out after Bobby, shoulder to shoulder into water so deep that there was no imagining what was underneath your feet. I can't swim. Never could. My skin burns and I keep my clothes on over my suit for all but a few minutes on the beach. My parents took us to Coney Island when we were children, my mother carrying the rented umbrella and the bag of towels. It was a lot of trouble for nothing. Grace and I huddled in the shade, running in our t-shirts to and from the water like nocturnal animals woken up in the middle of the day. My insteps, peeking out from the broad shadow of the umbrella, burned so badly they had to be covered in salve as white as their natural color. Bobby and Robert never even wore sunscreen. "I think we've ruined a beautiful friendship here," I said. "No, we haven't. We're still friends." "Not you and me. I don't know, maybe you and me, but definitely you and Robert." Mike Reardon squinted through his sunglasses and shrugged. He was like me, already a bright, feverish-looking pink. An Irish tan, we'd call a sunburn when we were kids. "What would you have felt like if someone took your mother out?" he said. I laughed. "It's not imaginable to me that anyone would take my mother out," I said. "There you go," said Mike Reardon. "Sometimes I think it's the strangest thing. We grow up in our family seeing our parents as completely sexless beings, and then we're supposed to know how to have relationships." "My parents were completely sexless beings." "In your mind, maybe. That's what we all think. My parents used to send all of us to 9 o'clock mass on Sundays, and then they'd go to 11 o'clock together. I was 23 years old before I finally figured out why they fought us so hard when one of us wanted to sleep in and go to later mass." "I bet your mother just needed the sleep." "Nope." I asked her one day. She said, "Oh, grow up, Michael. You have 6 brothers and sisters." That was our first date, I suppose. At least that was what Robert seemed to assume. He appeared to know instantly, almost chemically, that Mr. Reardon had gone from being a friend to being a threat. I suppose I'd had a chemical reaction, too, the first time we were running together after the carnival. The sound of us breathing sounded different to me, and when we brushed up against one another accidentally, bare arm to bare arm, as we had dozens of times, we now both lurched back to our own side of the dusty track. No matter what Cindy said, and said, and said again, I wasn't attracted to Mike Reardon. Didn't have a Jones for him, as Clarice Blessing, the pretty smart-mouthed black nurse in the ER on my shift, used to say about any good-looking man who came in with a broken bone or even a bullet wound. Once, I remember, Bobby came in, when he'd had to get my signature on some bank papers, and Clarice had been behind the front desk. "Tasty," she said, before someone told her who the dark guy in the pressed jeans and the white shirt was. "Tasty, but dangerous." That's how I thought of my taste in men. tasty but dangerous. Mike Reardon was the least dangerous guy I'd ever known, and every time I thought to myself, well, Fran, he's just not your type, I had to remind myself that my type was the type who left marks.
Benny asked me if Mr. Reardon was your boyfriend, Robert said one day after school.
Oh, yeah? What did you say?
I said you didn't have a boyfriend.
The next week, Mike took us out for pizza and a PG movie. One Saturday, we went bowling and then ate Chinese at a cinder block place back behind the supermarket that turned out to be pretty good. Robert pointedly asked for chopsticks while Mike used a fork. You will have a great dinner with two people you really like, Mike read off his fortune cookie.
Let me see that, said Robert.
He squinted in the dim light of the restaurant, hung with red and gold paper lanterns and signs for Chinese beer with a dragon curled around the bottle.
The journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step, Robert read accusingly.
Yeah, that too, Mike said. I think that's what we're looking at right here, a single step.
I hate fried rice, said Robert. Fried rice isn't real Chinese food.
Eat the dumplings, I said. Or whatever, said Mike, shoveling in fried rice with his fork.
You had to admire his patience.
The beginning of March, the air softening, turning warmer, Mr. Castro took Benny and Robert to a Hialeah game at an arena 1.5 hours south of Lake Plata. And Mike took me to a restaurant in Lakota named La Caravelle, where they set everything on fire at the table except the wine. I was starting to look at him differently, the way you do, seeing the pale hairs on the back of his hands, the places at the corners of his brow where his hairline was beginning to inch back along the crown, the V of his shirt where his throat met his chest. The fourth time we were out, Robert away for the night, me in a dress and heels, I was afraid of him. I kept my knees from nudging his beneath the table.
Can I ask about your divorce? Mike said when they had put the cherries flambé in front of us.
Do you have to?
Robert seems like he thinks that you and his father will get back together.
Did he say that?
Not exactly. He does seem to think that you won't be around here for long, like you're going back to where you come from.
Which I guess means he believes you're going to get back together.
Don't all kids say that?
Lots of them. Sometimes it's true.
In this case, it's not. I stayed with him a lot longer than I should have because eventually I thought I'd get perfect enough to make things better. I figured just by being nice or being quiet or being pretty or sweet or stupid, I could make things all right. I was wrong.
For the record, I already think you're pretty perfect.
Don't say that. That's what screws everything up, that perfect crap. Because the people who don't stay, they leave because it's not perfect, because they think it's supposed to be. Or my sister. She gets involved with one shitty married guy after another, and she's managed to convince herself that it's because she's working on this, that, or the other thing. But really, it's because if she met some nice, available man who loved her, she'd have to settle. He'd be nice, but not smart enough, or smart, but not handsome enough, or something. No one likes to settle, even though we all do.
Mike looked down at his hands.
Sorry, he finally said.
Jesus, I said. What set me off that time?
I said you were perfect.
Well, there you go, I said. And we both smiled and then looked down at the table again.
The check lay there like a message, as though if I picked it up instead of a scrawl of abbreviated entrees and numbers, there would be some word, some warning. Fran Benedetto, Fran Flynn, Beth Crenshaw, whoever you are, whatever you call yourself, why the hell are you doing what you're doing?
out of the frying pan, into the fire. You're not single. You're not ready. You're not interested. You're not who this man thinks you are. You're not who you think you are. You're not. I looked at his hands. I couldn't help myself. They were big, the line of the knuckles knobby and square, and I wondered what he would say if I asked him if he'd ever hit a woman, and knew that I didn't need to ask. Whatever it was that had made me soft and wet and warm whenever Bobby Benedetto whispered in my ear was part of whatever it was that made him twist my arm and slap my face. I'd been seduced by the danger I only faintly divined when I was 20 years old, and the danger was being caught by the cops with my jeans around my ankles on a bench along the beach in Far Rockaway. I looked at Mike Reardon across the table as he took his credit card from a brown leather wallet and knew that he was maybe the safest man I'd ever met, and that was his bad luck, and mine too. Patty Bancroft used to talk about how her husband had been two men, really, one mild and avuncular, the other a purple-faced monster. But Bobby was all of a piece. And if anyone had asked me, when we both were young, if I thought he could ever do what he did, I would have said, "No, my God, are you crazy?" And deep inside, a part of me would have known, not that it was possible, but that it was inevitable. "You look a little tired," Mike said. "I am." Cindy likes to lecture me about how different dating is today than it was 20 years ago when we did it last, but she gets most of her information from daytime talk shows and the dark hints she picks up from single mothers to whom she sells Avon on her evening calls. She keeps telling me that men now expect you to put out, she still says put out, Cindy, as though sex is transactional, on the first date. But that isn't the problem. The problem is that there is less to do on a date when you're a grown-up. Dancing at bars seems silly, and there are no more of the kind of Saturday night parties where you can French kiss in the corners. As we left La Caravelle, the owner in his rusty tuxedo bobbing and grinning and urging us to return, I realized that Mike Reardon and I were running out of restaurants. "Love is lovelier the second time around," Cindy liked to say. "How the hell would you know?" "Oh, don't be so touchy," she said. "You know how few single men out there are really interested in a relationship?" "I'm not interested in a relationship," I said. "Oh, please," Cindy said. "Please come inside," Mike said when we got to his place, in a condo complex out by the city limits. And when we were inside, in the living room with a couch and matching love seat that looked as though they'd been arranged in exactly the same way they'd been arranged in the furniture store, he said, "Please stay." I wasn't used to a man who asked, a man who said please and later thank you, bashfully, boyishly, and something about it irritated me. But still I went along, maybe to prove to myself that I could love a nice man, a good man, a man who would look at his hands when I gave him a hard time and not use them against me. I went into the bedroom, listened to the sound of zippers coming down and shoes hitting the floor as though they were sounds from some dumb show on the radio, sound without pictures. I tried to be there. I really did. But it was as though the wine and the dark numbed me, sent me into a trance. I was watching myself doing what I was doing, envisioning the curve of my back above the slight swell of my hips, looking at the cesarean scar that his fingers found hidden beneath the hair. I kept my eyes shut, but it was as though my eyes were in his hands. He kept whispering my name, and the sound of it was soothing, almost hypnotic. "Beth, Beth, Beth, Beth." "And yes," I finally said. And perhaps it was that made me open my eyes and remember all in a rush suddenly the last time I had had sex with another man, so vividly, so detailed that it might as well be happening again, in this strange bed with the plaid sheets and the dark wood headboard. It was like having a ghost there, hanging over me, pushing his knee between my own, holding me down with the weight of his chest hard and furred with black hair, his harsh, guttural whisper, like a knife at my throat, "Come on, come on." Using himself as though his whole body was a knife, cutting into me, breathing fire and Canadian club into the side of my face, his jaw set so hard that I could feel the stone of the joint digging into my cheek. "Beth," Mike Reardon whispered again. And I had to look up at him, had to keep my eyes open, to remind myself that it was not Bobby. That Bobby's hair was not light, his shoulders not sloped that way, his face not soft like this. Mike looked back at me, and he must have seen something in my face. Maybe I was wearing the look I'd had that last night with Bobby as he raped me. There ought to be a different word to describe what it is when it's your husband who does it. When it's a man you've invited, longed for, loved, hated, feared, known, desired. But there's only that one. I remember sitting with a college student one night who'd been pulled into an abandoned building near the subway and sodomized by a teenager with a gun. "It's like he stole my soul," she sobbed, eloquent in defeat. Maybe Mike looked down and saw the face of a woman who'd had her soul stolen, who was broken and empty, sere as a seed pod in autumn. Whatever was in my face, he couldn't go on. "Are you all right?" he said. "Yeah," I said. "I was hurting you." "No, it's okay." He fell back against the pillows, his forearms crossed over his face. He smelled like lemon cologne, and his voice cracked like a boy's. "Oh, God," he said. "Please don't say that. Don't say it's okay. For 4 years, I lived with a woman who forced me to pry everything out of her with a crowbar. I'd say, 'Lori, what's going on? What's the matter?' 'It's okay.' That's all she ever said." "I'm fine," I said. "I'm tired." I could not look at him, nor he at me. I could still feel Bobby on me like a weight on my chest. "Beth," Mike said as I got out of the car at my own place. "It's okay," I said over my shoulder, and went inside and took a shower. I love to look at Robert when he is pushed and sleepy, his face a little crumpled, his eyes half closed. Sometimes, after Bobby hit me, I'd go in and look at Robert and make myself feel better. Make myself settle down and shut up. When he's headed toward or away from sleep, Robert's face looks innocent, unmarked, as though nothing bad has ever happened to him. Will ever happen to him. He looked that way standing by my bed, holding an old earthenware bowl with a few greasy kernels at the bottom. "Could you make us some more peanut butter popcorn?" he said so nicely, even though he knew the answer was yes. Only Robert and I knew that it was his 11th birthday. He'd always liked the story of how the pains came but the baby didn't, of how they'd taken us into an operating theater and put up a screen at my breastbone to shield Bobby and me from what was happening below. Of how Bobby stood up to straighten out the crease in his pants legs and caught a glimpse of the incision like a big red mouth and the blood around the edges of the drape. Of how he sat down hard on the metal stool at my head. "Are you okay?" I asked. "Bobby, are you going to be all right?" The OB nurse, who'd been a class ahead of me at nursing school, gave him a big, clean whiff of oxygen. Robert laughed, to think of his father so helpless. He liked that story, loved it. I'd told it 100 times. Bobby couldn't handle the sight of blood. What a laugh.
Robert's birthday was July 4th now, or at least Robert Crenshaw's was. But on April 9th, we invited Benny and three other boys from the basketball team for a sleepover in the living room. They came carrying sleeping bags and video games. Chelsea was on a sleepover that same night, her first, with a little girl named Melissa Erickson, whose room, Cindy said, was entirely pink. She had been an in vitro baby, and her parents acted as though anything, from a playground spill to a B+ to a mosquito rattling around the stall shower in her pink bathroom, was what my mother used to call a federal case. It was a good beginning for Chelsea, who seemed less fearful now since the carnival, since she'd seen the worst with her own eyes. Melissa Erickson's parents were as fearful of life as Chelsea was, maybe more. It was Robert's first sleepover, too, unless you counted the nights he'd spent with Grace and his grandmother, Anne Benedetto bringing him back to the house with new sneakers, a new shirt, a toy, a book, a pocket full of candy and change. He'd spent the night at the Castros a couple of times, but he'd never had a friend to his house overnight. Bobby had thought that that was fine. He didn't like strangers in the house.
"I don't get all of this sleepover stuff," he'd said. "I never had anybody sleeping over at my house when I was a kid."
And I'd never had anyone except Gracie, breathing in the next bed, her freckled legs tangled in the brown blanket. Robert always said that he didn't want any kids to stay over at his house anyway. Maybe he was afraid of what they would hear, of what they would say. "Robert, what's the matter with your dad? Why is he yelling like that? What's that noise?" Maybe he was afraid to let them into his nighttime life, those kids who hadn't learned when you needed to be deaf and blind. Maybe it was the dim memory of that night when he was 3, when he came downstairs, his face soft and pink, his eyes squinted shut against the light, and said, "Why are you crabby, Daddy?" It was the first time he'd ever come downstairs when we were fighting. It was the last time he ever had.
"Get back in bed, Robert," Bobby had said, his supple voice hard, not loud, but mean. Mean. "Don't you ever get out of your bed or come out of your room unless I say so."
"How come?" Robert had said.
"Get upstairs."
I stayed upstairs reading during the sleepover, listened to the murmur of the boys' voices from the living room, read and dozed and read some more. When I came down to make more popcorn, they were halfway through the second Star Wars movie. The guy who was Luke in the movie had a car accident, and they had to, like, put his face back together, said a boy named Andrew Kovacs as the 5 of them lay on the floor, comic books and video cartridges around them. "You can tell," Benny said. "His face looks different after a while, like his eyes are different sizes." "I never had peanut butter popcorn," said Anne Lee Thong, a Vietnamese kid who was the goalie and whose school name had naturally become Goalie. "His mom is a really good cook," said Benny, as though I wasn't even there. So normal, the long black velvet evening, the stars bright over central Florida, a moon almost full rising outside the bedroom window. It was hot during the days already, but at night it was only warm, a soft warm that felt good when I stepped outside before bed to look at the sky. "Gentlemen," I said, as I handed them a second bowl of popcorn, "here's the deal. I don't care how late you stay up," Goalie cheered softly, "but if you wake me up, you're all going home. Hear me?" "Yes, Mrs. Crenshaw. Thanks, Mrs. Crenshaw. We'll be quiet. We understand." The heavenly host, boy voices hovering between soprano and tenor, their words slurred by the popcorn in their mouths. Upstairs in the dark, I could still hear them talking, hear the sound from the television, but it was muted, as though someone had thrown a blanket over them all. The way sound came through the walls when the couple who lived next door to my parents' apartment,
The fourth one, I think, or maybe the fifth. We'd play the stereo late in the evening and fight with each other next to the bedroom where Grace and I slept. Gracie held a glass to the wall the first couple of times to hear what they were saying, but it was dull. "She says, who does he think she is, his mother?" Grace whispered to me. After a week or two, we learned to sleep right through it. In the pale blue light from the window, I could make out the furniture in my room. The big scarred bureau, the landscape over it that I'd forgotten from Cindy's basement, the rocking chair, the darker shadow of the closet door. And I realized, as one of the boys belched loudly downstairs and the others laughed, then chastised one another in loud whispers, that it had become my room. I knew its contours in the dark. To know the streets nearby, where Royalton met Poinsettia, where Miramar met the highway, that was one thing. To know a bedroom in the dark was something else. Something final, something fine. Even when I heard the sound of someone below at the living room window, I knew enough to feel only tired. Tired and happy. I could tell by the whispers, a little louder than the whispers of the occasional tropical winds around the building, that the group of girls who were staying at the Castros, Benny's sisters and their friends, had come to hassle the boys. One giggled, another squealed. The boys heard them, too. The movie was shut off, there were mutters from below, and the sound of the door opening. The crowbar beneath my bed seemed ridiculous, like a prop left over from another movie on this same set. I opened the window and looked down on the five girls gathered in a little knot. I remember doing this with Dee Stemple and some other girls once, when a group of the boys from Holy Cross were camping out in Mr. Dolan's chop shop, sleeping on the linoleum floors in the office. Two of the girls below were carefully holding something in their hands like gifts. I coughed, and one of them dropped hers, and water arced up little sparkles in the air. "If anyone throws a water balloon into this house, you are in big trouble," I whispered, and they screamed and scattered. Just after 3, I went downstairs to turn off the lights. All five boys were sleeping with their mouths open, their hair askew. Andrew had his thumb in his mouth. Goalie's little video game was still on, football players running at one another constantly, falling down, getting up, sending the ball in a spiral across the screen. I had met his parents at soccer games. They alternated, one staying at the restaurant while the other stood silent on the sidelines. I turned off the little game, turned off the lights, pulled the cool sheets over myself. This is the life I always wanted to have. Five boys asleep on the floor, with nothing to wake them except the giggles of little girls. It felt so ordinary. "God, you look chipper, considering," Andrew's mother said as the boys spilled out of the kitchen and toward the front door, climbing into her van to head out to a day-long basketball clinic at the middle school. "In this case, looks are deceiving. I'm going back to bed." But I never made it. I was stacking the cereal bowls in the sink when the phone rang. Again, there was no answer, only breathing on the other end of the phone. All the ordinariness of the night before. The sense of being settled and secure, of my boy being an ordinary boy. All of it just slipped away. "Bobby?" I whispered, defeated. And then there was a cough, a gasp, a sob. "Mrs. Nurse?" came a small voice, and I leaned back against the counter. On my way to the Levitts, I stopped and bought an extra value meal from McDonald's, large fries and a Big Mac. Mrs. Levitt was sitting in the dark of an apartment in which the blinds had been neither raised nor open. She smelled of perspiration and sleep in dirty clothes. And she did not speak as I opened the door with the key she'd given me and moved past her to the bed, stopping only to lay a hand lightly on her shoulder. It was the first time I had ever been in the apartment when there had been no sound. the television still. Irving Sturtura's breathing silenced. Even the big Seth Thomas clock had wound down. Irving's body was a little cool and beginning to stiffen. Mrs. Levitt had pulled the sheet down to his ankles, as though one last time she wanted to look at what, for so long, had been the scarcely noticed landscape of her life, even more than her own body, which required a mirror to see. "You waited for me," I said, taking her hand. She nodded. "That's good," I said. "Can I call now for someone to take care of things, or do you want to wait a while?" "A minute or two," she said, and shuffled into the kitchen in her house slippers. I could hear her open the bag I'd brought, then the sandwich wrapper. "What time was it?" I called. She carried her lunch to the card table on a cookie sheet. "Nothing for yourself?" she said. I shook my head. There was a box of matzo on the card table, and I remembered that it was Passover. "I hope I didn't bring the wrong lunch," I said, looking at the box. Mrs. Levitt saw me looking and shrugged. "You think God's gonna be upset that I ate a hamburger?" she said, handing me the ketchup package to open. She was silent, eating, and finally she patted her lips with a napkin. "I was watching the cable news around midnight, maybe," she said, "and I fell asleep on the couch. And then I woke up around 6. Some kind of report on geese they had, and the sound they made woke me right up. And I said to Irving, they'd wake the dead, those birds." Her shoulders rose high and fell, just one dry, strangled sob. "I was changing the channel to the one on NBC with that young girl I like, the one that just had the baby. Then I couldn't hear nothing from the bed." She said something else, one more sentence, but it was in German, Yiddish, or Hebrew. I couldn't tell the difference. "I got to go to the bathroom, sweetheart," she said vaguely and shuffled out of the room. She looked better when she came back, more alive. She crossed to the hospital bed. "Take that thing out, sweetheart," she said, and I went over and removed the catheter tube. Then Mrs. Levitt pulled the sheet up over Irving, up to his bony chin that stuck up now like the prow of his body, proud and hard. Then she leaned close to his ear and whispered something, then patted his shoulder. "I was hungry," she said, sitting down and looking at the debris of her lunch. We called the Jewish funeral home in Middle Lake, and an hour later two men came. Black suits, soft voices, a collapsible gurney that came up and went down on the freight elevator. The hospital bed stood empty by the window, and as I opened the blinds, finally, the sun fell full upon the white sheets that Mrs. Levitt and I had changed only 2 days before. "I can have this stripped and out of here in an hour or two," I said, "or I can leave it just as it is, whichever will make you feel a little bit better." She sighed. "Leave it, sweetheart," she said. "Is there someone I should call?" She shook her head. "Irving had two older sisters," she said. "They treated him like a prince, his mother too, like a king. They're all gone now." "For you, I meant." "I had two brothers and a sister. They're all gone a long time ago." She sipped at her soda, going warm and watery. "Almost 50 years we were married. It's a long time." "It is a long time. 48 years last month." "How do you meet him?" "Ugh. Everyone wants to hear the story. He liberated me," she said. And I smiled and rubbed the thin skin of her hands, cross-hatched, age-spotted.
The 5th of May, they told us after. We didn't keep track of time. One girl who slept on the shelf above me, she made marks with a piece of stone on the wall. She died of something. Coughing, you know. And then sometimes we didn't know what month it was, not even what year after a while. You could smell from a long way those little white flowers, so sweet. There were none of them, so you could see, but you could smell. When we woke up, all the guards were gone, and one lady who helped them, she was going down the road, looking back like she was afraid we would come after her. There was nothing to eat. There wasn't anything to eat for maybe a week or two. Two of the girls were dead, but we waited for someone to take them. They died all the time. You'd wake up in the morning and see that someone wasn't moving from their bunk, and then you'd know. So that after a while it was nothing. Like seeing a rat or the sun or anything else. Just someone dead again. A lot of them died with their eyes open. That's not so nice. She looked over at the hospital bed. Otherwise, it looks more like you're sleeping. We went outside because of the smell. You'd think after all that time we wouldn't notice. They soil themselves, see? Well, you know that, with the nursing and all. So we went outside. Seda, the girl I sat with, she was from a farm somewhere. She talked and talked always, at night, in the morning. She was a big fat girl when she came, but she was skinny then, like the rest of us, with no hair on her lower place, no boobies either of us. We were modest when we came, like young girls, you know, but not after a while. We saw dust coming, and she said it was the guards coming back. I thought maybe she was right because I saw the trucks and the uniforms. But then they got close and we could see that they were different from the guards. Then we saw the flags on one of the trucks and we knew. One of them, young, with brown eyes and a little mustache, he came and stood by me and he said something in English. But I didn't know it was English. I didn't know English. I said in German that I couldn't understand, that I couldn't speak English. Then in German he said, "It will be all right now." He looked like he was crying a little bit. I said to him, "We are Jewish, sir. You should know that I am Jewish." And he said, "Yes, miss, so am I." She waited a moment, as though always here in the story the audience had had something to say. But I was speechless. Sergeant Leffitt, I never heard of such a thing, a Jewish soldier. And they had food. Seda stuffed herself and then was sick right on the ground like a dog. They took us to a special tent and gave us something for the bugs. The clothes were not so good. Her eyes shone suddenly and she smiled. But I was a pretty girl, even in ugly clothes. I learned the word later. Liberated. He liberated me. Everybody liked the story. One soldier, he put it in a special soldier's newspaper they had. Sergeant Leffitt liberated me, and he brought me home and married me. His mother and sisters, they weren't so happy. There was a girl around the corner they liked better for him. Sophie,